Okay. I had a feeling there's something.
All right. So we're holding on your test summit phase, 10 lines from the bottom, the last word line. London's video also. Turning up on him. You're learning a Bryce, continuing on this topic of when we do and don't believe Adim to say about something in the Shtar. So up until now, we've been talking about various cases where the Adim themselves were who signed as witnesses on the Shtar are coming and saying there was something wrong with it. We were children, or we were Psula Adim, or was a Shtar Amana, etc., all the various permutations that we've talked about. Now we have a new case. Shnayim chasumim al hashtar. You have two people who are signed on the shtar, Reuven and Shimon, umesu, and now they died. Uvo shnayim min hashuk v'omru. Two other people come off the street, Levi and Yehuda, v'omru, and they say, yadayinu shekhtav yadam hu. We recognize that this is their handwriting, which is, again, one of the valid ways of being mekayim a signature. Aval anusim hayu k'tanim hayu p'suleidus hayu. But they're saying, on Reuven and Shimon, that they were omrus, or they were children, or they were p'suleidus. Then we believe them for the same reason as the original Adim themselves. At this point, we're assuming we're going to ask about how that could be, but we'll get to that in a minute. But at the moment, we're assuming it's again Apesha also Apesha Hitu.
They're saying that themselves were...
They're saying... Levi and Yehuda are saying that the original Adim, Reuven and Shimon, were K'tanim, or P'sula Adis, or what have you. On the face of it, then, since we're relying on them to certify these signatures, to validate these signatures, then they have a Pesha also a Pesha Hitu. They're the one telling us that the signatures are genuine, but they're also in the same breath telling us that the signatures are invalid for a side reason, and therefore the argument is we should believe them. And again, the Im Yesh Adim Shechsav Yadim Huzer, if there are other Adim that this is Reuven and Shimon's handwriting, and they didn't say that that it was an onus or they were children or whatnot, or there was a copy of the Ksaviyad that was available from another source. Namely, what kind of other source? And the Braisa spells out, which we'll talk about a little further, what this means. Mishtar shakara olav arar. Mishtar shakara olav arar v'huchzik v'beis. Didn't you have a shtar that was objected to? Somebody objected that the shtar was forged or paid off already. V'huchzik v'beis. But then it was certified by Beis Din, which then that makes it stronger, the fact that it was challenged and then proven to be genuine. And Einu Nemonin. Then we don't believe the second set of Adim to say that the first set signed under duress or as children or what have you, because again you don't have a Pesha Asa Pesha Hitir. You don't have this we're not relying on them to vouch for the genuineness of the signatures, therefore we don't give them the right to say that the signature that there's some other problem with them.
We don't call them Rishayim.
No, we're not calling. No, of course not. We're just saying, very nice. We hear what you're saying, but we can't. That's empty. Very nice. We hear what you're saying. It's empty. Very nice. We hear what you're saying, but we can't accept that to invalidate the shtar. We have a written shtar here. Now, the question is, though, in that last case, though, what does that mean? Does that mean that we treat that document, we completely ignore the second set of Adim who are claiming that the first Adim signed under duress or as Ketanim or what have you? Does that mean we completely ignore that and we would even be able to collect with the Shtar? The Testament Bay is near the bottom. Isn't it, even if we don't say Apesha also Apesha Hitu, as in the first case, but even in the second case, don't we have a case where you have two Adim against two Adim? Namely, in an ordinary case, if you have two Adim that say that Reuven owes Shimon money, and two other Adim come and say, no, he doesn't owe him money, then we say, the usual rule is, we say two against two, you don't have any proof one way or the other. Uki tre levahadi tre, you put the two against two, and we'll quote this soon, uki mamona b'chazkas mara, and you leave the money in the possession of the one who currently has it. Now, in other words, there's no proof that Reuven actually owes this money to Shimon. Reuven has that money in his possession currently. We don't have any proof to take it away from him and give it to Shimon. So in this case, if these second Adim are claiming that the document's no good because the Adim were forced to sign it or what have you, all the various cases, why should we say that? We ignore them to the extent that we say we actually collect with this shtar. So Rav Sheshet says, you know what, you can prove from this. Now, you have there's two ways that you can have a second set of Adim contradicting the first one. These two ways are called Akasha and Hazama. Hakasha is where the second set of Edim are arguing against the matter that's being testified about. So one set of Edim comes and says that on a certain day we saw Reuven lend Shimon $100. And a second set of Edim comes and says, can't be because on that day Reuven was in New York and Shimon was in California. That's Hakasha. That's Hakasha. We're contradicting their evidence. As opposed to Hazama is a case where you make them Edim Zomimim, that's the case that the Torah talks about where we give the first set of witnesses the punishment that they intended to have happen to the other guy, to the guy they were testifying against. Hazama is the second set of witnesses come and say, you know what, we don't know. Maybe Reuven did lend Shimon money in New York on that date, maybe not. But you are not able to testify to that because you were with us in California at the time. That's called Hazama. Now, these are two different kinds of processes. One is arguing against the Eidos itself, against the matter that's being testified against. One is attacking the matter that's being testified, saying that it's not true. The other is attacking the Edim themselves, saying you can't be Edim for it because you weren't here. And the Torah says in that case we believe the second set of Edim. The second set of Edim, and we punish the first set.
And in the case of
Akasha, we say that we just it's two against two, so we don't have any proof, and we throw out the case. The Gemara does talk about, in particular in Sanhedrin and some other places, whether in that case will we ever allow the first set of Edim to testify again. If it's been shown that they're liars, maybe we shouldn't. That's a whole different discussion. Yeah. But anyway, so Rav Sheshes is saying Hakasha Tchilas Hazamahi. Hakasha is the beginning of Hazama. What does that mean? So different Mefarshim talk about, does it literally mean that it's the beginning of it, as in, so to speak, the first stage? Like you start, in other words, some Mefarshim explain, what the Gemara is saying by that is, when is Hakasha considered a valid Hakasha? When it's something that could potentially lead to Hazama. In other words, in the case that we were just talking about, you could have that a second set of Edim come and say, first of all, Reuven was in New York and Shimon was in California at the time. Second of all, you guys were with us in California at the time. Other Mefarshim say, the Ritva says, that it doesn't literally mean Akasha Tchilas Hazamahi, as in you need one leading to the other. It's just a way of saying that Akasha and Hazama are similar in the way they work.
Different degrees,
in other words, but it's not
sequential.
Right. So what does that mean? Shem Shein Mazimin Etz Eidim Ela B'fnehem. Just like you can't do Hazama against Eidim only in their presence. Because in general, when Rashi points out, whenever Edim are coming and testifying against somebody in Beis Din, that person has to be present. Here, the second set of Edim are coming and testifying that the first set are liars and need to be punished. They need to be there. Lahavdil, in American law also, a person has a right to face their accuser. So Hazama has to be done in their presence. Kachin Machishnas Edim El B'fnehem. So also Hakasha can only be done in the presence of the Edim. Therefore, Rav Sheshes argues, that's why we're saying that in the second case of the Braisa, that the second set of Edim are coming. Now remember, the first set of Edim are dead, or otherwise not able to appear in Beis Din. And therefore, which actually, I mentioned just now this first explanation that Hakasha Tchilas Hazama means that Hakasha has to be something that could lead to Hazama. So Rabbi Akiva Eger actually asks on that based on our Gemara over here, if we're saying they're dead, it can't mean that, because then you can't have Hakasha that could lead to Hazama. Or maybe actually that's what Rav Sheshes means, since in this case no Hazama is possible because they're dead, therefore there can't be any Akasha.
Hazama is
where you're saying you guys were elsewhere at the time.
Right.
If the first set of Edom are dead, then there's no Hazama because you can't be Mazim them. They're not there to confront in Beis Din.
But then Hazama, the Beis Din asks the question
specifically. Obviously the Beis Din is going to ask the second set of Edom questions, sure. They have to cross-examine the second set of Edom, of course. Yeah. Anyway, Therefore, in the case of our Braisa, the second case, since the first Edim are not available, and the second set of Edim are coming to claim that their Edus is invalid because they were coerced or what have you, it has to be Bifneim. If they're dead or otherwise unavailable, then you can't do that. Therefore, yes, Rav Sheshes is saying, therefore the Braisa is saying, in that case, we ignore that completely. We don't even consider that to be Hakasha. If it's not Hakasha, then yes, it's perfectly valid Shtar.
Because they're not there to be there. Potentially there, but the process is flawed.
Yeah. However, Amalei Rav Nachman, wait a minute, Rav Nachman says, Ilu hava kamon, umachishin lahu, suppose that the first set of Edom were there in Beis Din, and the second set came and contradicted them. Hava chosha, obviously we would say it is considered a valid contradiction, v'loi hava mashgichin lahu, and we wouldn't pay any attention to the Edom that are signed on the shtar. We wouldn't say that the creditor can collect based on the shtar. Because now you have an edus which has been contradicted. You're going to tell me hashna delesnu. So now, what are you saying? The first set of edim are not around. The ilu havel kamon, and if they were before, dilma havel moiduluhu, and maybe if they had actually been around, and when the second set of edim come, maybe the first set of edim would have admitted. You know what? You're right. We were anusim or ksanim or what have you. Mehemni. Anusim means they were forced to sign illegally. Mehemni, so we should believe him. In other words, the question is, why effectively what you're trying to say, Rav Nachman, is that their edus becomes stronger by the fact that they're not there. If they had been there and based in, then we would allow the hakasha. You're telling me because they're not there and there's no and therefore there's no possibility of them admitting that they actually wrote it falsely or whatever. Therefore, you're going to say the edus is stronger. What's the logic? Incidentally, also, Mepharshim talk about the question when the Gemara is mentioning over here that maybe they would have admitted. Is Gemara just mentioning that as like a side point, or is that essential to the thing? In other words, if the first set of Edim in fact admit in Beis Din, you know what, we lied, will Beis Din accept that? Or we lied, or we were tanim, or what have you, will Beis Din accept that? We talked yesterday about the concept kiven shehigid shuvei nechozer umagid, that when a witness has said something in Beis Din, we don't allow them later on to retract it and say differently. Do we apply that in this case? Do we say that maybe kiven shehigid only applies that they can't modify their edus, but they can say that they can sort of take it back altogether. Well, not take it back altogether. The point is, here you have a second set of Edom contradicting them. Maybe once you have a second set contradicting them, then we would add to that the fact, you know what, that they themselves admit. Maybe we would accept that. Or maybe we say, Kivin Shehigid applies across the board. The Gemara is just mentioning that as an incidental thing. Yeah, it's logical that if the second set of Edom come, the first ones are likely to say, you know what, after all, they're right and the whole thing was invalid. But not that would actually make a difference to the proceedings of the case. Anyway, Elo Amar Rav Nachman, so no, Rav Nachman says, rather, as a matter of fact, the Braisa does not mean to imply that you allow him to collect using the shtar, which has been contradicted by a second set of Edim. When we say Ein Elu Ne'amonim, it means we don't believe the second set of Edim means, in other words, that, so what does it mean? It means, we have this shtar, and the debt in it is kind of in limbo. On the one hand, we can't allow the creditor, the malva, to collect on the shtar because there's been an objection raised against it. On the other hand, we're not going to either say let's rip it up and forget it. The whole loan is canceled because we're not sure. What happens in particular? Suppose that Reuven goes and seizes property of Shimon. Without consulting with Beis Din. Tosfos discusses over here the question when we say throughout Shas that if somebody seizes it, if he's Tosfos, that he's able to keep it, do we mean that right now in the middle of the proceedings he goes and seizes it? Or do we mean that, for example, let's say he has property of Shimon's in his possession from beforehand, say a previous loan that Shimon had made him or a deposit that Shimon had made with him or whatever? Anyway, we would say. Well, so one second. Let's finish up the sentence, and then I'll explain. And then let me re-explain. The point is, what we're saying is like this: Beis Din is not going to allow Reuven to collect on this debt written in the shtar because we have a problem with it. But if Reuven has in his possession an amount equal to that debt that originally belonged to Shimon, we will say, you know what? We also don't have any proof to take it away from you and return it to Shimon. So that's what I'm saying. Tosfos discusses the question. Are we talking about that now, if Reuven were to go and seize some property of Shimon, then we'd say, you know what, we don't have any proof to take it away from you? Or are we talking about specifically that we mean beforehand? He had, for example, previously Shimon had deposited something worth $100 with him.
That's right.
Yes. So now Reuven will say, you know what, to satisfy that debt, I'm going to keep this thing. that you deposited with me. Ordinarily, I would have returned it, but since I'm claiming that I'm owed this debt, then I'm going to keep it in satisfaction of it. And Beis Din would say, in other words, since we have a doubt on this shtar, we can't allow you to collect outright, but we also can't prevent you from keeping what this object that you have in your possession already.
What?
No, because if he doesn't have anything in his possession,
okay,
yeah,
he doesn't get, but so he does.
Okay, that's the thing. So that's what we mean. In other words, when we say that we don't, in the first part of the Braisa, when we say we believe the second set of Edim means the whole shtar is canceled, we rip it up, it's worthless.
Yeah, but that's
the second case, in the
first case the shtar is canceled, we don't say we can go back, take away from Shimon. Second case.
No, that's exactly. If the shtar is canceled, meaning in other words, Reuben is left with nothing.
Right.
Not only he can't collect his debt, but even if he has in his possession a deposit, for example, that Shimon made with him, we'll tell him the ordinary rules of deposits apply to it. You've got to return it to Shimon when he wants it back.
Right.
As opposed to, in the second case of the Braisa, where we say that we're not sure, where Rav Nachman is saying, therefore, Rav Nachman is saying that what we do is the shtar is sort of in limbo because we don't know whether we have written on the shtar that the Edim signed it, and there's no evidence in the shtar itself that there's any problem. But we have the second set of Edim contradicting that. So therefore, the money itself remains with Shimon if it's in his possession. But if Shimon happens to have any money or property that's currently in Reuben's possession, then we'll allow Reuben to keep it. So uki tre lahadi tre. So we will put. Rav Nachman says uki tre lahadi tre. But uki mamoni bechazkas mori. So you put two against two, and therefore you leave the money in the property of in the possession of its current owner. Midi dehava anichta de bar shatya. Because this would be similar to the case of the property of bar shatya. Bar shatya literally means the fool. We've learned previously. We've learned in Chagiga and in Yevamos about the concept of the shoyte. So this person was somebody who sometimes, maybe he had epilepsy or whatever, sometimes he was healthy and sometimes he was a shoyter. So what happened? The Barshatya Zavin Nichsi, one time this Barshatya sold property, real estate. Also Beitre, Amrikru Shoyter Zavin, two witnesses and came that he and said that he did it when he was normal, when he was in normal shape. But also Beitre, so Shoyter Zavin. Sorry, two people came and said that he sold when he was a Shoyter. But also Beitre, Amri Kru Cholim Zavin. Two others came and said it was when he was normal. So we have a contradiction. If it was when he was Shoyter, then there was no sale. If it was when he was normal, then it's a valid sale. So what do we do? Amar Ravashi, same idea. Uki Tre Lahadi Tre. You put two against two. In other words, you're not sure which one, you're not sure which set of Edim are correct. You have no particular reason to believe one over the other. So we leave things status quo. Okay, Mamoina, or Ara, it says on the side, Bechazkas Barshatya. So you leave the property in the possession of Barshatya because he had a chazaka on it from beforehand. We know, in other words, that we know at one point this property belonged to Barshatya. We're not sure whether it legally ever belonged to the person he sold it to. So therefore, we have to go back to the last known to the last known state, which is that when Barshatya owned it.
What, does it give money back to the other person?
Maybe. Yeah, I guess so. Because even the Edim who claimed that he did it when he was a Shoyter,
right.
they still say that money exchanged hands. Yeah. This set it says on the side over here, Ara versus Mamona, Meforshim point out the difference is that the land, you say that the you, land, because it stays in one place, therefore you can talk about the Chazkas Morakama, it's called, the fact that the previous owner had a Chazaka on it from beforehand. Whereas when it comes to movables, metaltalin, then you don't say that necessarily. That's why they take out the word Mamona over here, because if it was money or any other movable property, not necessarily. That changes hands very easily.
Yeah.
Whoever has it right now has it. Yeah. However, the Gemara points out, this that we're saying that we would return the property to Barshatya would only be if he had a chazaka on it from his father. In other words, it's not just that we know that he himself previously owned it. It's that we know that he inherited it from his ancestors, where then we know that his title to it is clear. But if he doesn't have a chazaka, if this is a piece of property that he himself bought at one point, well then, amrinin kroshoyta zavin or kroshoyta zavin. Then the same way as we're assuming that he might have been a shoyta, that he might have been having a fit of epilepsy or whatever when he sold it, same thing when he bought it. So he has no more chazaka than the person they sold it to.
Shoyta zavin means
he bought it, or kroshoyta zavin, and when he was a shoyta, he sold it. I don't know how many of us are familiar with the Piyot Chagadya that people sing at the end of the Seder, because it's not in the Lubavitcher Haggadah. But the standard text of it has that the Chagadya de Zabin Abba Batrei Zuzi, that my father bought for two Zuzim. But we see from all Gemara that's wrong. It's not supposed to be de Zabin, it's supposed to be de Zvan, that he bought. De Zabin would mean that he sold it for two Zuz. Anyway, so the point is, then Bar Shatya wouldn't have any more chazaka on it than the person that he supposedly sold it to. So then we wouldn't say that we return it to him. Because if we were going to go that way, we'd have to say we have to return it to the original guy he bought it from.
That's for Kaka.
We're talking about for Kaka. For Metalpalin, there's nothing to talk about even. But even for Kaka, it has to be, even for land, it has to be something that we know that Bar Shatya owned it free and clear, in the sense that we know that he owned that his ancestors, that he inherited it from his ancestors. Yeah. Going back to what we said about Hazama and Hakosha, we mentioned before, we said that the Rav Sheshes had said that Hakosha and Hazama are similar, either that they're two parts of the same process, or at least that they're similar in the sense that both of them have to take place in front of the first set of Edim, but now a different opinion. Amar Rav Abba, no, there's a difference. Ein mazimin es ha'edim ela b'fneihem. When it comes to Hazama, you can only do it in front of the first set of Edim. Because then you're trying to get them punished, you're trying to get them executed or fined or what have you, whatever they were planning to do to the person they were testifying against, and that has to be done in front of them. But when it comes to Akosha, when it comes to just contradicting the Edus without impugning the Edim themselves, that can be even not in their presence.
But that's a detrimental way. Still do it when they're not present.
Because the difference is when you're doing Hakosha, you're not directly attacking them. You're attacking what they said. It comes out as a side effect from it, and a side effect of it, it comes out that they're going to be possible leaders, maybe, or you know, or in certain cases or whatever. But that's a side effect. As opposed to Hazama, the main effect of it is that you're testifying that they gave false leaders and that they need to be punished, and that has to be done in their presence.
No punishment.
Right. Well, that's the thing. Hakosha, it's not that there's no punishment, but they're declared as postal ages.
That's right.
Yeah. But it's only a side effect of the fact that they it's only a side effect. It's not the main thing that the Edim are after. So therefore, according to Rav Abba, it can be done not in their presence. You have the Dalit by here, so I guess so. And he points out Hazama shalei b'fnehen, and suppose that they do Hazama not in the presence of the first Edim, nehi de Hazama lo havia kasha mihavia. Then it's true, we won't consider it Hazama. We won't be able to punish them. We won't be able to punish them financially or bodily or what have you. Hakasha mihavia, but we will at least consider it Hakasha. Given that we're saying that Hakasha can take place not in the presence of the first Edim, then yes, if they come and say, we know these guys are lying because they were with us in California then, we'll consider that Hakasha.
But we wouldn't believe them more than the first
We wouldn't one. Believe them. No, so that's the thing. Hakasha means that we say we don't know which set is lying. Yeah. I think the din as far as when you have two sets of Edim like that, when there was Hakasha, if I remember correctly, and I didn't look it up, but if I remember correctly, it's not so much that we say the first set of Edim is disqualified from giving Edus, because, yeah, I mean, you know, why should we say the second set is any more truthful than the first? But it's rather, suppose you have, in a different case, you have one aid from the first set and one aid from the second set are coming to testify, then you have a problem. Because you know for sure one set was lying. And so then you know one of these two Edim is a possible aid. Then you have a problem.
Then the two kitas absolutes.
No, so that's the thing. We're not saying the two kitas absolutes, but we're saying one from each cat would be puzzled together. Because necessarily one of them. Yeah. Actually, Tosfos quotes it over here. From a Gemara in Bava Basra, that each we will accept in the future each one individually, but if one from each set comes, or all four of them come as a group in the future, then you're going to have a problem. Another din, going back now to what we said before in the Braisa, Amamar, Im Yesh Edim Shepsav Yadam Uze, we said in the second case of the Braisa that if there are other Edim besides these ones that are claiming that they were Ketanim or what have you, You have other Edim who testify that this is the original Edim's signatures. Or we said you have another sample of their handwriting on file, namely Mishtar Shakara Olav Arar, from a shtar that was objected to, that was challenged, Behuchsik with Beis Din, and then it was certified in Beis Din. Then we say Enemonim, then we say we don't believe the second set of Edim, and that was the discussion that we had just now, what we mean we don't believe them. Do we mean that we don't believe them at all because they're not in the presence of the first Edim, that was Rav Sheshes, or is it that we don't believe them to completely disqualify the shtar, which is Rav Nachman? Anyway, the point is the Braisa had mentioned this idea that you need a shtar that had previously been challenged and then was recertified by Beis Din. So, which implies, Kara Olav Arar Ein, only if the shtar had previously been challenged, then yes, after it's been certified, after it's been Hochzik with Beis Din, then it's good to use as a sample for the future. Loi Kara Olav Arar Loi, but if not, if it had never been challenged, then no, because then we have to be concerned, maybe that it itself might be forged. Messiah Leila Ravasi, this supports what Ravasi said. Amar Ravasi, Ein Mekayman as Ashtar, Ela Mishtar Shakara Olav Arar V'Hochzik B'Beis Din, because that's exactly what Ravasi says. You can only certify one shtar based on another shtar which had been challenged and then Hochzik and then recertified by Beis Din. The Friedrich Rebbe quoted this in a sicha about Yurtis Kislev, and the Rebbe used to quote it occasionally also, the idea. So we see from this, when something's been challenged and then certified, that makes it stronger than if there was no challenge in the first place, and they applied the Friedrich Rebbe, and the Rebbe applied that, among other things, to the history of Chassidus. Chassidus, we know, in its first couple of generations, was very severely challenged, and it both down here on earth and Lamaila, that there was the famous accusation, Lamaila, against the Alter Rebbe, why is he spreading Chassidus so much? So then, after there was that objection, and then it was certified that, yes, the famous story with Baal Shem Tov and the Mizrach Maggid came to the Alter Rebbe and told him, now that you're already spreading Chassidus, you should do so even more, that's a Shtar Shekola of Arav Hochzik, that makes it even stronger. There's also actually it's also brought I think in Avodraham and in some other places that's also the idea when you say Amen to somebody else's bracha. The Gemara says elsewhere that the one who says Amen is even greater than the one who says the bracha. Why? Because when you say a bracha, when you say it, you're sort of certifying that what the other person said in the bracha is genuine. Yeah. So the rabbis of Nahavda said, "Ein mekayim as a shtar ela mishteik tzubus." You can only certify a shtar. You can only compare the signatures and then declare it genuine based on two tzubus. In other words, we were just saying you need one document that had been challenged and then was recertified. The Nahavda are saying you need two tzubus, oy mishteik tzubus, or two documents of sale for two different fields. This is only if the owners of those two fields had actually been able to use the produce of those fields for 2 years, sorry, 3 years, Ubashufi and calmly. Rashi says Bashufi means below Iru without any objections. And during those whole 3 years, nobody ever came and objected, you know what, the sale was invalid, this field really belongs to me. Once that happens, we say they have a chazaka, then that means we can accept that the bill of sale really is genuine. Because if it wasn't, somebody would have come and objected all that time. The Rambam puts it slightly differently. The Rambam puts it that Bashufi means that they enjoy these fields, they use these fields like any person normally uses their field during those 3 years. They plowed and they planted and they harvested and whatnot, and yeah. And no objections turned out.
What if they were afraid that somebody would come, they might not, if they thought there was any validity
to the objection, for example, they might not be so careful to plant to plow it carefully because I'm not going to be keeping it forever anyway. Why should I bother? Yeah.
But I mean, even if they did it partially, does mean that they were afraid that someone would come.
No, but in other words, if they did it completely and then it lasted for 3 years, then that reinforces it. So actually, the Rambam explains that these two things are not really contradicting each other. It means, and this is how it's Paskin and Shulchan Aruch, that it can be one or the other. You can have a shtar that was challenged in Beis Din and recertified, or you can have two ksubas or two bills of sale that these same edim are signed on or whatever. So a shtar shakal al-arar, in other words, has the strength of two regular shtaris. And Shulchan Aruch also talks about a couple of other interesting possibilities. Can we, for example, compare the signatures of Edim based on other samples of handwriting we have of theirs? Let's say we have a sefer that they copied out back in those manuscript days. What if we have a letter that they wrote? Does that work? So a sefer, they talk, it says in Shulchan Aruch, maybe if their name is actually signed at the end of the sefer, then fine, that can be strong enough evidence that they actually wrote it. A letter, not necessarily. People just write letters. It's not, you know. This that you're saying that you can use two other psubas or two bills of sale, field. So Rav Shimi Ba'ashi says, this is only if those two other documents are in somebody else's possession, not in the possession of the person who has this. Right now we have one document which is being challenged and based in. The person who has that document, the malva or whatever it is that has that document, can't be the same one who has those two other bills of sale or those two other psubas. But if it's in his own hands, then no. Because then, what if all three of them? What if all three of them are forged?
What do you mean his own hands?
In other words, not in his name. In other words, we have Reuben and Shimon are coming. One second, Reuben and Shimon are coming to Beis Din. Reuben claims, Shimon, you owe me $100. I have a shtar to that effect. Shimon starts arguing the shtar is forged. The signatures are forged or whatever. We have to get it certified by Beis Din. If Reuben himself has two other documents with the same edim signed on them, let's say two other documents that show, let's say, that he bought fields from somebody else, and they have those same edim signed on it, we won't accept that. Why? Because what if Reuben forged all three documents? He forged first two bills of sale,
but these two documents are not forged.
Maybe if he brings edim, that would be different. Okay, but we're talking about if it's not a matter of edim, he's bringing out two documents. Look, I have two bills of sale that I previously bought two fields. These two edim, Yisachar and Zvulun, are signed on both of them. Why don't you compare it with this one? How do we know? What if he forged all three of them?
And those two stars were not recorded.
Exactly. Yeah. So therefore, so what Rav Shimi Ba'ashi is saying is, if we have those two documents are in somebody else's possession, if they're not Reuben's documents, but rather they're Levi's documents,
then
they're good. Right. Now, the question...
Wait a minute. The person initially could forge three documents, give two away.
Come on. No, but it's also, remember, the documents would be saying that so-and-so sold this property to Reuben. If they're in Levi's possession, why would they have Reuben's name on them? Anyway, the question is, why is it we're saying that if all three documents come from the same person, then no good, because maybe he forged them. What if he looked at the signatures and copied them? How does it help if they're in somebody else's possession? Maybe one day Reuben went over to Levi's house to visit, looked at, no, that's different than your case. Your case is that Reuben took two documents that are in his own name and gave them to Levi. No, we're not talking about that. We're saying these documents actually say Levi's name on him. But Reuven one day went over to visit Levi. He looked at his shtar.
Written with Levi's name and given them to Levi after.
No, come on. But maybe he went over to Levi's house, Asav Azayef, and then he went back home and forged one based on what he saw. The answer is Kula Haile Matzim Chavin. We don't assume that he's going to be able to copy the signatures so exactly if he doesn't have them in front of him. Mela, if he has two documents like that in his own possession, sure, it's easy for him to practice until he gets it right. But if he just saw it one day at Levi's house, we don't assume he's going to be able to copy it so exactly.
Who's going to bring the document subconscious? Not talking himself?
No, so in this case, he'll ask Levi, do me a favor, he goes and puts up a notice in shul. You know, do me a favor, I have it. Yeah, somebody. So I have a document over here with Yisachar and Zvulun signed on it. The lawyer is objecting and saying that it's forged signatures. If anybody else has documents that are signed by Yisachar and Zvulun, please bring them to Beis Din.
Yeah. I can't say give it to me.
We learn in a Braisa, new din. Kosev ad medusa al hashtar. A person can write his edus in a document. And then he can give edus on it based on that written memo even many years later. Right. So now there's a few different explanations what this means exactly. Rashi over here says it just means very simple that if somebody has been an aid on something, so he was there, for example, when Reuben lent Shimon money or sold a field or what have you. He's worried that he may forget the edus, so he goes home and writes it in his diary. That's what we're talking about. Years later, when they actually summon him to Beis Din, he's able to look at his diary entry and remind himself. The Rif quote, the Rif quotes from Rav Hai Goin, who has a different explanation. It's talking about that, for example, Reuven lent Shimon money without a document being written, just in the presence of Edim. Time passes, and one day Reuven comes over to the Edim and says, "You know what? This transaction that took place in front of you guys, please go write out a shtar for me, or here's a shtar that I wrote out. Please sign it for me."
He paid the money back?
No. Obviously, if Shimon paid the money back, that wouldn't work. The reason why that works is because since Shimon knows that these two Edim were present, if he had paid back, he would have made sure to tell them precisely to prevent this kind of thing. So therefore, if these Edim are being approached by Reuven long afterwards and asked, "You know what, now I decided I better write a shtar in order to safeguard my rights, please sign it," they can go ahead and do that. However, this is only if Ed remembers it on his own. Meaning, so according to Rashi's explanation, it would mean that even without looking in his diary, he remembers something about it, he just may not remember the details. He uses the diary to refresh his memory. And according to Rav Hai Goin, it would have to be that the Edim themselves basically remember the transaction. Whereas Rabbi Yochanan says, no, even if he doesn't remember it on his own, even if he has to actually look at the diary to remember it, then he can still he's still able to. That we'll get to now in the Gemara. Rashi adds though that if he doesn't remember it at all, then no, because we said yesterday, we didn't mention yesterday. The pasuk says that Edus has to be verbal, mipihem, from the mouth of the Edim, but when mipiksavam, not based on what they wrote. Tosfos has a very long discussion about the pros and cons of that. In particular, it gets into the question, do Edim actually have to appear in person in Beis Din, or can they write down their testimony and send it to Beis Din? According to this Rashi, it comes out that not. Tosfos says that they're not allowed to. Besides what we're saying over here, we're talking about looking in their diary. There's also a related thing, since we're saying the PM Valema Piksavam would also mean, according to Rashi, that if the Edim are not able to show up in Beis Din, it's not good enough for them to write out their testimony and send it to Beis Din. There's no written depositions. Tosfos discusses that at some length over here and says that no, if the Edim are unable to talk, that's different. Yeah, then we don't accept written Edus instead of verbal. If they're able to talk, if they would be able to come to Beis Din and just right now their schedule don't allow it, then yes, we will allow them to write it down and send it to Beis Din. I don't remember.
They wrote it.
So that's a different discussion over here. What do we mean over here? So I'll tell you something else. The Rambam discusses the issue. Suppose the Rambam goes so far with this Mipiyam Vilayim Piksavam thing. The Rambam writes, if the Edim are actually signed on the Shtar, but now sometime later it comes, the matter comes to Beis Din, and the Edim have no memory of the matter, but we see their signatures over there, then the Rambam says, no good. And the Rambam actually goes so far as to say that anybody who doesn't pass in that way doesn't really understand how halacha is supposed to work. Where, of course, the Raiva jumps right in and says, and then says, we do very well know how the halacha works. This that the Gemara is talking about over here is them having to look in their diary or whatever. If they're actually signed on the shtar, who cares whether they remember it or not?
If they die,
that's different. Yeah.
Maybe
who doesn't remember?
They did.
Well, they're dead.
They're dead. Okay, so maybe he doesn't remember it so good.
So then, according to the Rambam, you're not going to say that. As long as they're alive, because even if they're alive, the fact is we don't have to rely on them. Remember, there's five different ways of certifying their signatures on the shtar. If they themselves don't remember, fine. Dismiss them. Find somebody else. Find other examples. Find the Shtar Shekola out of Ara or the two other documents as we just talked about, and certify it that way. But you can't have them certify it according to the Rambam if they themselves have no memory of the thing at all.
What does it mean, having memory? It
means that they remember. At least I remember that. I remember sometime maybe five, maybe seven years ago, Reuven lent Shimon money. I don't remember how much. I don't remember where it was, but at least I remember the basic idea. But if yeah, okay. Omer Rabba, Shma Minim Rabbi Yochanan. We can derive from this that Rabbi Yochanan is saying that even if the aide doesn't remember it himself, that he can look up his notes. we learn from this, Hani Beit Shei Yadi Sadusa, that if two people know a certain Eidus, Umin Shichad Minayu, and one of them forgets the Eidus afterwards, Mitka Chad L'Chavre, then it's allowed, one of them can remind the other, and that's considered okay. It's not considered that the second Eidus testifying by hearsay. Because neither of them is a Negev, neither of them has a stake in the matter. So therefore, since Rabbi Yochanan is saying that even if he doesn't remember it himself, he looks up in his notes, and that's good enough. Same way, if the other aid reminds him, that's also good enough. Now, the question is, Ibayilahu, your question, Asmai Mai, what happens if one of the Baal Dinim himself reminds the aid? In your case, the Malve, but it could just as well be the Loive. Rav Chaviva Amafil Atzmai. So Rav Chaviva says yes. Even if one of the parties to the case, one of the Baal HaDinim themselves, reminds the aid, that's also good enough. Whereas Ma Brei de Rav Ashi says that no, you can't have one of the litigants themselves remind him. And that's in fact the halacha that one of the litigants himself can't remind the aid. However, there's a loophole in that. If he eats tzurva mid abonan hu, if he is a Talmud Chacham, Afib Asmai, then even himself. Now, who is the Tzurva Mirabbanan here? Who is the Talmud Chacham? Rashi says it means the aid. If the aid is a Talmud Chacham, he knows the Dinim of Eidus, he's going to know that he can't testify unless he remembers the thing himself. So it'll be fine. The other guy, whichever litigant it was, jogged his memory. But then he's going to start searching in his brain until he actually manages to get it back. It's not like he's just going to be testifying. It's not like he's just going to be parroting back what the guy said to him.
Yeah, principles, but what makes you think he has better memory or brain?
Not necessarily that he has better memory, but the fact that he has principles.
And
the fact that he has principles.
He's going to disqualify himself.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Believe it that he knows.
Yes. Yeah.
Because he knows the halacha.
Because
if he doesn't remember, he's going to.
He's going to say, "I don't know." Yeah. The Rambam explains it a little differently. The Rambam says that we're talking about the Talmud Chacham over here is the litigant, the one who's reminding the aid. A Talmud Chacham, again, knows the dinim of aiders. He knows midvar sheker tirchok. He knows that you can't lead on the witness. So again, he's going to be careful. He's going to be very careful to do it in a way that he's not leading him on. That he's just jogging his memory.
And it's valid
according to that. Yeah. And we have a case. He holds it up. Ashi have a yadir levi sadrusel of kahana. As we have the case where Rav Ashi knew some edus in favor of Rav Kahana. Amalei. So Rav Kahana asks Rav Ashi midochu ma hai sadrusa. Do you remember this particular matter? So you can give edus on it. Amalei loy. Rav Ashi says no. He asks Rav Kahana asks him. Balav hachi v'hachi haba. Didn't it happen like this and this? Maybe not giving all the details, but at least the general reminder. Amalei lo yadayna. He still says I don't know. Also, idka Rav Ashi. In the end, Rav Ashi did remember. Asid lay, and he actually came and gave Edus and Beis Din. Chazil Rav Kahana to have a machzem. So he sees Rav Kahana is like stuttering, all of a sudden you were saying all this time you don't remember, and all of a sudden now you remember. What happened? Are you sure this is good Edus? Amalei. So Rav Ashi tells him, "Mi sabres aloch kasamichna." You think that I'm actually relying on you? That basically that I'm just parroting back what you reminded me? No, anohu d'ramoy anafshoy v'adkri. I knew that I'm responsible, so I thought about it over and over until I remembered the details.
That's what we mean by
Talmud Chacham. So according to Rashi's explanation, since Rav Ashi is a Talmud Chacham, we assume that we know that he has the principles and he's not going to give Eidos unless he really remembered it himself rather than just relying on what the other guy told him. And according to the Rambam, it would be the same idea. Rav Kahana being a Talmud Chacham, he would have been careful. Rav Ashi is telling Rav Kahana, you yourself were careful to not tell me any more than I need in order to jog my own memory. Doesn't say. Now the Gemara is going to go off on a tangent, which is going to get back to this idea about people remembering Eidus, about people remembering Eidus after a long time. This is a situation in Hilchos Tumah V'Tahara. Tanan Hasam, we learn in a Mishnah in Ohalos, Hatzluliyos, Hakroivos, if you have mounds of dirt that are close to the city. Now these mounds are, they're people.
Tzulius,
it's mentioned tail. What? Maybe we may have had the term in Shabbos. I don't remember. A tail is a hill. So Tzulius is a small hill. What is it? The thing is, it's very common, as the Gemara is going to say soon, that because they're not on the road. If they were on the road, then people always pass over them. People would be very careful not to bury anything in them. That would make people tummy when they pass over it. But because they're off to the sides of the road, nobody passes over them anyway. So therefore, people feel free, as the Gemara is going to say soon, to bury body parts and whatnot in them. So therefore, we have a question: when do we consider them tummy and when not? So akroivos, if they're close, bein la'ir or bein la'derech, if they're close to the city or close to the road. Echad chadashis ve'echad yishanis, then whether they're new or old, tmeis, then we consider them tamei. Harachoykos, but if they're further away from the city, chadashis, yataharis, yishanis, tmeis. If they're new, then we assume that they're tahar, because we don't assume that anything has been buried in them. If anything had been buried in them, people would know about it. Yishanis, tmeis, whereas old ones are tamei. Ezri kroiva, chamishim ama. What's considered close to the city? Rashi and Tosfos have different explanations, and within Rashi itself, Marsha and Maram Shif have different explanations of what exactly the situation is. Which of these criteria overrides the other? In other words, basically, we're saying there's a matter of new versus old, and we're saying there's a matter of close of close versus far. According to Rashi, it comes out that if it's close to the city, then we say even new ones are tamei.
Why do we have to take either or? Why don't we say?
Because that's, the question is basically: so if you have what are we saying? What is the Mishnah saying? The Mishnah is saying that if they're close, then new and old are all tamei, and if they're far, new ones are tahor and old ones are tamei. So what does that mean? In other words, so basically, are we saying, in other words, that if you have a mound close to the city, then even a new one is considered tummy, or is it the other way around? Rabbi Chananel says the other way around, that if they're far away, even old ones are tummy.
Why don't we say third possibility? Those that are close and
well, you have those four possibilities, right? Close and new, close and far,
right.
far and new, far and old.
Right.
We have to figure out which ones are we saying over here that we assume to be tamei. Yeah. So the ezi kroiv, a chamishim amah, what's considered close is if it's within 50 amas. The ezi yishana shishim shana, and what's considered an old mound, where then even if it's far away it would be tamei. Rashi says would be if it's 60 years old. If it's 60, divrei Reb Meir, that's what Reb Meir says. Because if it's 60 years old, you can't assume that anybody remembers. Nobody, you know, the mound has been there for at least 60 years. You can't assume that anybody remembers anymore whether anything was ever buried in there. Divrei Reb Meir, Rabbi Yehuda Omer. No, the definition is kroiva shein kroiva heimena. Near means that it's the closest one to the city. If it's any further than that, people are just going to bury in the closest one. They're not going to bother going to the next one. So therefore, we can assume the closest one is tamei, and any further one out is tahor. Yeshana she'edanam zeichra, and the definition of old is that it's so old that nobody remembers. That nobody remembers when this mound first started appearing there. So not necessarily 60 years. Now, the first thing we have to figure out, my ear or my derech. Yeah, it could be more, it could be less. It's interesting, actually, that Ramban, Shulchan Aruch, in this connection, since we're bringing this in the matter of Hilchos Eidos, that Ramban mentions 50. And the Shach tries to correct it on the basis of our Gemara at the 60. Some of the other notes of Caleb over there say no, that there's maybe reason to say that he meant 50. Yeah. My ir my derech. First of all, we have to figure out what kind of city and what kind of road. Ilema ir mamish derech derech mamish. Do we just mean any old city and any old road? Well, then seka mimachtikin and tumah. Why would we assume that these mounds are tamei just based on a suffix? You don't do
that.
We're talking about Eretz Yisrael. Ha'amar Resh Lakish, Ilam Matzu V'Taru Eretz Yisrael, V'Tiaru Eretz Yisrael. Resh Lakish says, it's the Gemara towards the end of Nazir, that they found an excuse to declare all of Eretz Yisrael Tamei. Tahar, I mean. In other words, the Chachamim wanted to be able to declare Eretz Yisrael Tahar, that unless there's an area which is known to be Tamei, then the rest of it is assumed to be Tahar. They found a weak, not so terribly strong a reason for us to be able to make such an assumption. We don't know. The Gemara doesn't mention it. Tosfos actually mentions, quoting from Rabbeinu Chananel, that Elah is the Aramaic word for rib. They found one human rib. And on that basis, they said, you know what, that rib, fine, there is the tumah. That's it. You know, once we disposed of that, once we buried that, we can assume everything else is tahor. The Gemara in Zvachim actually tells an interesting case also, where one time they found human bones in one of the chambers of the Beis Mikdash, and they were ready to declare the whole city of Yerushalayim Tomei on that basis. And Torah Yeshua gets up and says, "Haitachen, we're gonna declare the city of our ancestors Yerushalayim Tomei." They were very careful, he says, to remove any human remains. I mean, there were many Jews killed here the people who were killed by Nebuchadnezzar's armies, but they were careful to remove them. We shouldn't all of a sudden assume everything is Tameh because of this. Anyway, the point is, getting back to our situation over here. What? A donkey just killed doesn't make a Tameh. It's only people. Oh, a goy, that's a different matter. The actual bone would make a person tummy. It wouldn't, yeah. The actual body parts would make a person tummy by touching it or carrying it. What? Live goyim are not tummy midaraisa and midrabanan. It's a matter of zavim, not tumas mess. Anyway, the point is,
a bone from a goy
would be mitame, yeah. Anyway, the point is that why should we assume without any evidence that these mounds of dirt are tummy? Amr Abzera, because we're not just talking about any city. Ir means ira smuchal beis hakvaris. The city is a type of city which is close to a beis hakvaris, which is close to a cemetery. In other words, that you have, there's city A, which doesn't have a cemetery of its own. So they go to city B, which has a local cemetery, and they bury their mason there. Derech beis hakvaris. And the road that we're talking about is the road to the cemetery. So, Bishlam Ederach Beis HaKvaris. Okay, so I can understand then why mounds that are near the road to the cemetery are Tomei, the Zimnin, the Mishrami Bein HaShemoshes, because it can happen sometimes that they're burying a mess close to Shabbos, or Mikru Kavur Bepel, and they realize they're running out of time, and they quickly dig up one of these mounds and bury the body there. So therefore, we might have to assume there's Tumah there. Ela Irach Smuchal Beis HaKvaris, but when you have a city that's near the cemetery, what's the problem? Kulul Beis HaKvaris Azli, doesn't everybody in the city go to the cemetery? Why would they bury their dead in these mounds? Amar Rav Chanina, because it's not regular dead, Mitoch Shan Noshim Kovas Sham Niflehen, because women will bury their stillbirths in these mounds, they won't bother schlepping all the way to the cemetery. Umukashchin Zuraisayim, and people who have leprosy, where body parts fall off them, they bury those body parts in these mounds also. Well, first talk about this.
Used to bury them in the
mound? Yeah. Yeah, there's a Gemara talks about, we learned in Mud Cotton actually, that there's various ages. There comes a point when a child is old enough, Rahman al-Islam, that you have to have a proper levaya for them. But a baby, you don't have a full fledged levaya. Yeah.
But the women used to do it, not the men.
Apparently, yeah. Anyway. They have to bury these things because you don't want there to be tumah in Eretz Yisrael. You don't want kohenim and tumah to become tumah. The poskim also argue: do you have to bury these parts in addition because of covered ames? Is there a din when body parts, are, in the case of the mukashrin, is there a din when organs are removed from a living person? Do they have to be buried? And that actually comes up as a question in halacha. And in a number of cases, a person has to have a body part amputated, Rahman al-Islam, or an internal organ. Or, not necessarily. As we're saying, if it's not a matter of Tumah v'Tahara, maybe not necessarily. Rav Moshe Feinstein actually talks about it in a couple of his Trogus. In one place he says yes, and in another place he says no. So it could be he changed his mind. Anyway.
The
Pashtus, because the woman herself is the one who miscarries, so afterwards she goes. Anyway, so what's the point? Ad chamishim amah azli ihi l'chodah. So if the mound is within 50 amas of the city, says Rav Meir, who's the one who mentioned the 50 amas, he figures if the mound is within 50 feet, is within 50 amas of the city, azli ihi l'chodah, then the woman herself will just go and bury it, and therefore it may not become known. So therefore we have to assume that there may be tumah in this mound. Tfei dabra inish ba'adah, where if there's any further away, she's going to take a man with her for an escort, and then it'll become known. That man will be able to tell afterwards. So if we don't know, so that's why, if it's within 50 amas, we have to assume there may be a problem. If it's any further away, the mayor says, then we would assume if there was tumor in there, we would know about it.
They seem to be saying in a way that the woman who had that didn't want to advertise it.
Could be.
She did it on her
Could
own.
Be, yeah. So therefore, Hilkoch Tumah Eretz Yisrael, like Machzakinan. So indeed, we're not assuming that there's tumor in Eretz Yisrael without a good reason. In this case, with these mounds, we have a certain good reason. Now, how does this relate to our Gemara over here? Omer of Chista, Shma Mina Mira Meir, we can deduce from what Rameir is saying, if he says that an old mound is considered to be 60 years old because nobody remembers, That means Hai Sadu Sad Shitin Shnin Midgar Tvela Midgar. We can say then that a person remembers Eidos up to 60 years, but not more than that. If we're saying that once the mound is 60 years old, we don't trust anybody's memory that of what happened with it in the 60 years. Therefore, by the same token, with Eidos, yeah. However, the Gemara says, Velohi, that's not so. Hasam hu delay Ram Yaleh, the difference is, in that case, there's nobody who has particular responsibility for giving Eidos on it. So yeah, eventually, after 60 years, people may forget that. Aval Hocha, but in the case of regular Edom, a person was actually appointed an aid for something, given to Ram Yaleh, since he's responsible to give Eidos for it, after Latuvanami, then even if it's more than 60 years, we can assume that he's careful to keep it at least in the back of his mind and to be able to give Eidos about it even more than 60 years later.